today, episode 1 of a 2-part special looking at what we can learn from the first 100 days of the worst global health crisis in a generation.
I arrived in Wuhan at the Hankou train station. I saw a few people take photos of the sign that said that we had arrived. It was kind of late. The light is sort of gray-blue. And I guess it felt kind of weird to finally be in the place that we've been writing about and reading about this whole time. There were announcements saying, you know, anybody that's coming in from overseas needs to register. Because I have a U.S. passport, I was flagged, and I went through one area where I had to fill in some forms and have my temperature checked. So the first thing I did after arriving in Wuhan is to go visit the Huanan Wholesale Seafood Market, which is where all of this began. And it is closed, completely fenced off. There's this blue metal fence that goes all the length of both sides of the market. And then there's also police ticker tape that runs alongside the trees on the outer perimeter. And there was a little, kind of like a little guardhouse at the entrance. You know, I was asking them if the market would open again. They said they didn't know. It seems to be that the market will not open again. Across the street from the market is a shopping mall. Most of the stores and restaurants were still closed. But a few had started to open. There was a bar that was open, guys up there drinking. And there was another restaurant that was open. And when I tried to go inside, they told me that I couldn't go inside. And I had to stand in the doorway and talk to them. They just opened 2 days before and they were starting to deliver food to places, but they hadn't officially opened. Nearby, there was also a hospital that had been hit pretty hard during the outbreak, and everything looked normal and calm. There was people that were checking cars and people coming in were still in hazmat suits and taking temperatures, but they didn't seem, they didn't seem panicked at all. It feels still very quiet, a little bit too quiet, but you get the feeling that it's a huge improvement. I had a taxi driver who said that, you know, just a month ago, it felt like it was the end of the world and, you know, Wuhan looked like it was a city in a movie about the apocalypse.
The Guardian's Beijing bureau chief, Lily Kuo, returned to Wuhan on Monday as life as it had been was beginning to reemerge. Yesterday, the city took another step back towards normality. The lockdown was lifted 76 days after it began, and 100 after China first informed the World Health Organization of a cluster of unexplained pneumonia cases within the city. I don't need to tell you that what has happened since has been extraordinary. COVID-19 has torn through the world, from China through East Asia, to Iran and Italy, Spain, France, arriving in the UK, India, Australia, America and beyond, affecting 184 countries and upending the lives of billions of citizens. This week, as the city where it all began takes that tentative step towards recovery, cases and deaths continue to rise towards a peak in Britain, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson is himself in intensive care. A story as big as this can be overwhelming. It can be hard to process as the details wash over us day by day. Today, we're going to pause to try to make sense of it all. Over 2 episodes tracking those 100 days, we'll look at how different countries responded and ask whether their decisions saved or cost lives. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, COVID-19, the first 100 days.
So it was New Year's Eve, December 31st, the end of a decade.
Michael Safi is The Guardian's international correspondent.
And people were getting ready to celebrate, to say goodbye to one decade, to, you know, start a new one. And the mood was light in many places. But in one city in China, the industrial megacity of Wuhan, people were worried. Rumours had been swirling on WeChat and other Chinese social media of a mysterious SARS-like illness. At about 1:38 p.m., the very first news of the virus broke the surface. The Wuhan Health Commission website published a note saying that it had detected a pneumonia of unknown origins. At the time, it said there was no evidence of human-to-human transmission, no evidence of medical staff getting sick, but that people had something. They had fevers, some of them had trouble breathing, and the worst of them had lesions around their lungs. So at this point, the virus is concentrated in and around the South China seafood wholesale market. It's a place where, you know, lots of different livestock is mingled together. And from most reports, it's not a hugely sanitary place. Carcasses and lining a lot of the alleys, stalls are packed quite tightly together. And by January 1st, that market is closed and people are seen disinfecting the area around it. And officially at that point, there are 27 cases.
How quickly does it grow? And how quickly do they get an understanding of what this thing might be?
Well, by day 9, China's Center for Disease Control and Prevention knows what it's fighting. It declares that the pneumonia in Wuhan is a novel coronavirus, similar to SARS or MERS. Now, these were both, you know, devastating coronaviruses, but they were stopped from being major outbreaks for a couple of reasons. One was that SARS showed its symptoms really quickly, and MERS was much less infectious. So at this point, the key questions were, how long were people with this new disease asymptomatic, that is, not showing any symptoms? How contagious was it and how deadly?
Were the Chinese government open with the public about what was going on?
Well, what's unusual is that by January 3, the case count had grown to 41. And then between January 3 and January 17, not a single new case is announced. Nothing. It's as if the virus just temporarily vanishes.
In central China, a man has died following an outbreak of an unknown pneumonia-like virus, which officials say comes from the same family as the deadly SARS virus. Health authorities say that only 40 other people are infected.
Chinese health officials insist the situation's in hand.
It's largely under control. Most patients are showing lighter symptoms and some of them have already been discharged.
But what's strange about that is that even though there are no more new cases being announced in China, the disease is beginning to show up in other countries.
The mysterious new pneumonia virus that sickened dozens of people in the Chinese city of Wuhan has been confirmed in Thailand.
There was a case on the 13th of January in Thailand.
It's the first time the virus has been confirmed outside of China.
The next day, Japan declared its own case.
Well, it is indeed the headline story for Japanese media. However, the general public's not really reacting much. After all, it's just one case and the patient has recovered and has been discharged. And the health ministry says that his family has not been infected and there's very little possibility that the virus is spreading.
People on Chinese social media start to joke that this is a patriotic disease, that it only begins to present itself once people have actually left China. Actually, the disease was not just sitting there. It was spreading. It was everywhere.
And so by then, they must have known that it wasn't just spreading from animals to humans, but between people.
Well, there were certainly suspicions of that, but the line that the Chinese government maintained, the line that the World Health Organization echoed, was that there was no evidence yet of human-to-human transmission. And then, on the weekend of the 18th, it appeared that the dam broke China's case count suddenly began to surge. You know, it was in Beijing, it was in Shanghai, it was in Guangdong. And then on the 20th of January, a senior Chinese scientist went on state television and he confirmed what a lot of people had suspected and feared. Which was that there was indeed human-to-human transmission.
That it is contagious amongst humans. There is such evidence collected from Wuhan.
And the caseload started to grow.
Patrick Winter, diplomatic editor for The Guardian. We're on day 21 of this outbreak. It's January the 21st, and in the UK, news of a SARS-like disease is on the front page of that day's Guardian. Our Beijing bureau chief, Lily Kuo, writes under the headline, China virus can travel between humans. But it wasn't on the front page of other papers. And in fact, our main story that day was all about the Tories calling for a rethink on BBC funding. This wasn't really on the radar for Boris Johnson, was it?
No, I don't think, to be fair, it was on anyone's. It was largely seen in terms of making sure that any British people in China were got home safely, but the main focus was on a range of other things.
Hi, folks. Good evening and welcome to the first edition of People's PMQs of 2020.
Including, as ever, Brexit.
Ben Steele asks a specific question about fishing. Can we guarantee we'll have full control of our fishing waters after Brexit? It's one of the reasons I voted out, says Ben Steele. And the answer is yes, we will take back control of our fishing waters.
I mean, the government was still in very bullish post-election mood. They were refusing to appear on the BBC Today programme. Quite a lot of talk about the whole issue of levelling up across north and south.
High wage, high skill economy, uniting and levelling up across the whole of the UK. And that's the objective of this government.
It was really about making sure that Boris Johnson's domestic agenda was pursued and very much pursued on his terms.
But it was known about, as you say, they were looking at British people who were in China. It was in the news. So people at the top of government and Department of Health must have been thinking about whether there was a risk posed to the UK.
Yes, I mean, behind the scenes, the scientists and experts whose job is to look at pandemics and epidemics had been meeting, and they've been meeting specifically about what was going on in China. There's a meeting of one institution called NERVTAG on the 21st of January, the day after there'd been this admission of human-to-human transmission. Attending that was one of the most influential figures in the UK's response to this, one of the chief modellers of how epidemic spreads, Neil Ferguson. Chris Whitty, the chief medical officer, was there. They did move the risk level up, but they moved it up just from very low to low. And the main point of discussion was whether they should consider entry checks on people arriving from Wuhan, and they decided not to do so at that meeting.
Do we know why they decided not to?
Well, they just thought it was there was not sufficient threat, and they thought it might stigmatise members of the public, and they thought it might not reassure the public, but make them fearful, and there was no grounds to make them fearful.
At that point, do you know how far up the chain of government the warnings went?
Well, I think it had certainly got to the top of the Department of Health. Hancock was fully aware of the issue. There were notes going into his office about the need for new advice to be sent out by Public Health England.
OK, Michael, so that's the UK. It's on the radar, but barely. At that exact moment, 21 days after people first learned about what was happening in Wuhan, what's the reaction of other European countries and the US? Did anyone take more concrete action?
At this point, the virus is not really on the US radar.
Are there words about a pandemic at this point?
No, we're not at all, and we have it totally under control. It's one person coming in from China, and we have it under control. It's going to be just fine.
Okay. Nor really is it being taken very seriously in Europe, though Germany is one exception. I mean, there was a German scientist who, by mid-January, had actually helped to develop the first diagnostic test for the virus, and he had shared it with the World Health Organization. And within 6 weeks, that test would be in mass production with 1.5 million and test kits coming off the lines every week. I mean, Germany by that point already had a system in place to track infected people, quarantine them. I mean, it's the one exception, I think, in Europe that managed to get out ahead of the others. But even then, it wasn't particularly prepared compared to other parts of the world.
Which were the first places to react that were closer to China?
Well, the first place to react was Taiwan, which on the 31st of December, so back on day zero, recognised the danger of the announcement that the Wuhan Health Commission had made about the discovery of a pneumonia around the seafood market. And so on that very day, Taiwan instituted health screening for arrivals from Wuhan. So that was before any evidence of human-to-human transmission, before we even knew what this was. Anyone arriving from Wuhan in Taiwan could not get off the plane until they were personally checked by somebody at the airport.
Taiwan's Centers for Disease Control has issued a travel advisory ahead of the Lunar New Year holiday.
Within a couple of weeks, they had implemented over 120 different safety measures to try to contain the virus. And they were matched by other places in the region. I mean, Singapore had set up a government task force by this 22nd of January.
And the ministers are all here present. And if you have any specific questions relating to their respective agencies or ministries, you can pose a question to them and they'll be here to answer your questions.
Which was trying to implement measures to try and contain the virus in Hong Kong.
We have already met with different bureaus to heighten the surveillance and also the cleaning as well.
They were implementing technology to try to track the people who potentially had the virus and do contact tracing to figure out who they'd been in contact with. South Korea very, very rapidly brought the private sector into trying to develop a test.
In the car park of a baseball stadium on the outskirts of Seoul, they queue for a coronavirus test. This is one of dozens of drive-throughs across South Korea, where from the safety of your car, you can be tested for COVID-19.
And within a few weeks had drive-through testing set up so people could, on their way to work, line up and see if they had the coronavirus. They knew the potential for this to devastate their economy, to riddle their population, and they took quick action to try and contain it.
They knew its potential impact because they'd had a taste of it, hadn't they? They'd experienced SARS and MERS. Is the reason that these East Asian countries were quick to act less to do with proximity? After all, with air travel, viruses can travel anywhere, anytime, but to do with their experience of those epidemics? Is that what explains the dividing line between those countries that acted very quickly and those that did not?
Well, I mean, in the same way that a vaccine works, you kind of get a little kind of prick of the disease and it teaches you to fight the much bigger disease when it comes along. You still see the legacy of SARS all over that region, people wearing masks, hand sanitizers freely available. And it meant that they had spent the last two decades actually preparing for this very kind of outbreak. And when they saw the first signs of it emerging from China, they were ready. They knew what actions to take.
Right, so you've just given us a pretty stark contrast between what Patrick was telling us in the UK on day 22 and what was happening in all of those East Asian countries. Let's move forward through time now. How did the virus progress in China?
Well, China was the first to experience what's become really familiar to the rest of us, which is that exponential curve that you begin to see once coronavirus really starts spreading.
China's tightly controlled state media says the mysterious virus has now spread to some of the country's major cities.
The disease has infected more than 200 people and three have died since it was first discovered in the central city of Wuhan last month.
And which has now infected more than 300 people. Six people are now known to have died.
17 people are now known to have died. The number of confirmed cases of coronavirus has risen above 500.
26 deaths so far from the novel coronavirus and at least 830 infected.
The latest count was around 937.
By day 23, the caseload in China had crossed 1,000. 200 cases, and Xi Jinping told the country that it was facing a grave situation.
中共中央总书记习近平主持会议并发表重要讲话。
And that the city of Wuhan would have to effectively be quarantined right on the eve of the Chinese New Year holiday.
This is the moment caught by a TV news channel that a city of 11 million people is effectively shut off. Paramilitary police closed the gates at the station entrance as all departing trains are cancelled. In Wuhan's hospitals, medical staff in full protective bodysuits are treating hundreds of infected patients, while images on social media appear to show crowded reception areas with queues of people wearing masks and a system struggling to cope.
Within 5 days of that, something like 50 million people in China were living under lockdown.
Imagine the entire public transport system and motorways in and out of London or Birmingham being shut down in the run-up to Christmas. Perhaps only a communist, centrally controlled state could impose such sweeping controls.
So having been slow to actually realise the scale of the problem they were facing, the Chinese government suddenly snapped into action and began to implement a lot of these things that would become familiar later, which at the time were controversial. When China decided to quarantine Wuhan, public health specialists were initially critical. They were saying there's no evidence that this works, that it only helps to spread fear and undermine the quality of health in the city. But confronted with the kinds of contagion that the Chinese were seeing, they felt that they had no other option. And it was absolutely unprecedented. It was a giant public health experiment that they were embarking on in the face of a disease that was spreading more quickly than any disease we had encountered for 100 years.
And so this carries on through January into February. The situation is intensifying. How on earth do China try to understand more about what's happening and how serious this disease is?
Well, by this point, there are tens of thousands of cases of coronavirus in Hubei province. And that provides researchers a pool of data that they can use to try and figure out exactly the nature of this enemy that they're fighting. And so on day 48, a study emerges, which gives us the kind of first indication we have of just how deadly this disease is. And it tells us that approximately 4 in 5 people will only experience mild symptoms if they catch coronavirus, and they'll recover. And the mortality rate is about 2%. So 2 in every 100 people who catch this will die.
That's obviously a very high percentage, way, way higher than seasonal flu, and extremely worrying. But I do just want to pause for a second on that study, because they said 4 out of 5 cases were mild. And in some ways, I feel like that sent a signal to the rest of the world about what COVID-19 would be like. But what did they actually mean by mild?
Well, they used mild to mean, you know, everything up to and including pneumonia, you know, the serious sorts of things that you see when someone's suffering pneumonia. And I think the use of the word mild may have played into this phenomenon that, I mean, I experienced, which was that at this stage, I think we were looking for excuses to write this off, not to panic, not to feel like this was a big deal, because it felt like that's what always happened, right? I mean, we've had over a dozen major disease outbreaks this century alone, and plenty of people seem to die in other places. The disease always seems to dissipate at some point. You know, the adults in the room find a way to fix it. And so I think lots of people were trying to find an excuse to brush this off. And maybe when they saw that it was primarily older people who got sick, it meant many people said, well, this is just another thing not to worry too much about.
A week after that report had come out, by the 24th of February, which is day 55 of the outbreak, the World Health Organization said the virus had peaked in China.
China has now reported, as you know, 77,042 cases to WHO, including 2,245 deaths. The data from China continue to show a decline in new cases, which shows that the strategy of containment is having an impact in China.
The new death numbers halve and then slow down from there. During that period, the virus has now spread to other countries, and particularly to countries that are close to China. And I just want to ask you what's happening in the countries that you told me about before that had put in place really detailed preparations.
Well, look, let's put South Korea aside for one second. If you look at Taiwan, for example, which, if you remember, was hugely exposed to China as far as its economy, as far as tourists and population exchange, on February 24, they have fewer than 50 cases. If you look at Singapore, which also acted very quickly, you have 90 cases, no deaths. And Hong Kong, I mean, Hong Kong is like literally a bridge away from mainland China. Again, they have 81 cases. So at this point, things are looking okay.
But by then, in fact, just in the days before that WHO announcement, South Korea is facing a huge challenge.
That's right. So one of the things they're doing is pretty extensive interviews of people who might have the virus, contact tracing, and they come across their 31st positive case, so patient 31. And at first it looks like just another one of these cases they're seeing, except they find that the woman is a member of a Christian megachurch in Korea.
To God and Jesus, who saved us from death to life, I offer up all the glory and thanks for eternity to come. Hallelujah!
And that in the previous 10 days, she's attended two worship services with at least 1,000 members of the sect. Now, these guys are kind of in pretty close confines. There's a lot of singing and chanting. The authorities in South Korea realize that this woman may be what they call a super spreader, so someone who is spreading way above and beyond the kind of two odd people that every coronavirus patient is thought to have been passing it on to statistically. And their caseload suddenly begins to explode.
Across South Korea on Sunday, pews were empty, churches shuttered, and worshippers turned away as authorities fight to rein in public gatherings after a spike in coronavirus cases. South Korea is battling the biggest virus outbreak outside China. On Sunday, it announced 586 new coronavirus infections, taking the total to over 3,700 cases. And the day before saw the country's biggest daily jump, 813 cases.
So this outbreak was obviously, I mean, something really scary, but what it actually shows is that South Korea had a system in place that was able to withstand the kind of shock that this patient 31 presented, because cases did increase, but the government was able to actually figure out who had been infected. They interviewed over 200,000 people who were members of this church and, you know, expand this system that so far had been dealing with 30-odd cases to suddenly be dealing with well over 1,000 cases.
Now, let's move on to South Korea. Now, formerly South Korea had the biggest outbreak outside of China. So they have the highest testing rate of anywhere in the world. They are seeing about half the daily rate of cases compared to last week.
Okay. Now, and one of the things that I'm fascinated about with South Korea is whether they also had a draconian lockdown alongside that incredibly intensive targeting process.
So they didn't. I mean, there were social distancing measures put in place, but not the kind of lockdown that we had seen in China that we would see later in other places. And one of the things that Korean leaders said was that they were a democracy. And in a democracy, you know, it wasn't possible to restrict people's freedom in that way. And so rather than pursue a path of, you know, extreme social distancing measures, they decided to go the other way and just make testing as expansive and as well organized as possible. At this point, much of the world was watching the caseload in Asia increase and seeing that as a problem. But in fact, the fact that these countries were actually finding cases was a good thing. It was proof that they had systems in place. We would learn later that the more worrying position to be in was the one that the UK, Europe, the US were in, which was that they were only finding a handful of cases. And in the end, that wasn't a sign of strength. That was a sign of great weakness.
Next, Patrick finds himself in Iran as COVID-19 begins to spread out of control across the country. Patrick, in mid-February, you're sent to cover the elections in Iran. Is coronavirus one of the stories you were planning to cover while you were flying out there?
Absolutely not. Total admission, it was not on my radar whatsoever. I was concerned about what the turnout was going to be in the parliamentary elections, what they would mean for the Hassan Rouhani's government. And it was only whilst I was in Tehran, the number of people who were wearing face masks grew and the amount of traffic started to reduce. You started to see people wiping all the metal surfaces, or they were developing strange techniques whereby they could touch the lift buttons, whereby they would put out a cigarette lighter and then put a match on the cigarette lighter so the cigarette lighter's match would touch the lift button rather than their own finger. It was quite amazing how quickly people adapted and realised what was dangerous. And then amongst the kind of Iranians whom I was talking to, the conversation kept on turning to this issue of this disease and what was happening, particularly in the spiritual city of Qom, which is about 100 miles south of Tehran, that I realised that there was something else coming up on the horizon which I should be monitoring as well. And actually, it's pretty clear now that the virus outbreak had happened before the start of the elections, the parliamentary elections, but the Iranian government decided not to make that public, arguably for 3 or 4 days, some people say for at least a week. The health minister is giving a press conference where he's reassuring the Iranian populace that there is no great problem. But as he's doing so and it's televised, he's coughing and sweating quite profusely. And the very next day, he has to admit he has got the virus, and it spreads very quickly amongst the Iranian political class.
It sounds like they were looking in a different direction, and it sounds, therefore, like it contrasted quite sharply with what had happened in the countries and places closer to China that had begun immediately planning for how to prevent coronavirus entering their populations. I remember very clearly that this time felt like a game changer. That's what our health editor, Sarah Bosley, said, standing in the Guardian offices. She said, when you began to get cases that weren't related to individuals travelling from one country or another, popping up in Iran and then in Italy, then it looked like this could no longer be contained. What had become clear was the virus was spreading much more quickly and much more widely than previously realised. And you flew back to the UK via Turkey. What happened there?
I ended up leaving, I think, on the last kind of official plane out. I noticed there was a real anxiety on the plane because everyone was in proximity to one another. The number of people who were wearing face masks was way and way the majority by then. In midair, the advice changed and Turkey had said they weren't going to take any more flights from Iran. We were allowed to land in Istanbul and we had to have checks as we left the plane individually. And then standing alongside the man with the temperature gun was the man with the real gun to make sure that we did take the test. That moment of landing in Turkey made me realise that this was going to be a global phenomenon. And that in turn made me sort of notice that when I landed in London, there was no attempt whatsoever to ask me anything about where I'd been in Iran or how long I'd been there, or no attempt to find out whether I had a temperature. Just a completely normal passport procedure.
But despite the lack of checks, you then had to follow the rules and go into self-isolation. We've arrived at more than 60 days since the outbreak began in China. Do you think the UK consider it a serious threat by then? Are scientists talking about this?
Yes, no, they're meeting very, very regularly. The NERVTAG group meets on the 21st of February. There, they decide that the threat remains moderate, and they actually consciously decline to increase it, even though we're starting to see the first deaths in Italy on that day. If you speak to people in Number 10 now, they admit they were aware of the problem, but they didn't make enough plans in terms of buying equipment, getting the testing equipment, getting protective equipment for the health service, buying ventilators. They didn't do enough at that point. There was a failure to really plan for a major pandemic. What they planned for was something more minor. And I think if there's ever an inquiry, which I'm sure there will be, into what's happened, I think Number 10 would put his hand up and say they were slow at this period.
As time moved forward, I can remember how confusing things became. The situation was getting very, very bad in Iran, increasingly worrying in Italy, and everyone was trying to figure out what the UK government's strategy was. And I think we were getting quite mixed messaging. What was the strategy at that time? Was it clear behind the scenes? What discussions were going on?
I think one of the difficulties is that the government had a very long-standing plan going back about a decade, and it had quite abstract concepts such as contain or delay, and then it had mitigate or suppress. And these came across as very sort of clear dichotomies. And in fact, there was a bit more of a blur between those boundaries, between these concepts, in terms of how it practically worked out. But the main purpose of what the government was trying to do at this stage was to protect the most vulnerable, which they regarded as the most elderly or those most likely to have complicating diseases that would make them particularly vulnerable to the virus. That was the focus. It was not on a general attempt to suppress the virus right across the population, so we didn't see any more draconian measures such as social distancing. A byproduct of this, and not the purpose of this, was to possibly build up an immunity amongst the bulk of the population. And that would have an advantage in the sense that it would make it less likely that the virus could return, because the herd, the bulk of the population, would have developed the immunity.
But what you're talking about became hugely controversial, and people did wonder whether it was a deliberate strategy. On the 5th of March, Boris Johnson talked about one theory being that the UK could take it on the chin.
One of the theories is that, you know, perhaps you could sort of take it on the chin, take it all in one go, and allow the disease, as it were, to move through the population without really taking as many draconian measures. I think we need to strike a balance.
And then, as you've mentioned, Sir Patrick Vallance, the chief scientific officer, would talk about herd immunity.
Not get rid of it completely, which you can't do anyway, not suppress it so we get the second peak, and also allow enough of us who are going to get mild illness to become immune to this, to help with the sort of whole population response, which would protect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, that herd immunity, I know you talked about yesterday when you were appearing with the Prime Minister. In terms of building up a herd immunity within the UK, what sort of percentage of people need to have contracted the virus?
Probably about 60% or so.
Given what we'd seen in China, that did cause some real concern here. And soon it wasn't something that was going to be able to continue.
No, I mean, the danger was it came across as it was the objective, when in fact it was a byproduct of a policy designed to protect the most vulnerable for a specific purpose, which was to make sure the health service could get to as far as the summer without being inundated by cases. The danger is that you end up with an abstract paper that's written for specialists. It then emerges as a concept to the general public and can appear incredibly callous. And if you allow the virus to run through the population largely unchecked, people are going to die. And on the 65th day since this outbreak occurred, on the 5th of March...
The first death in the UK from the coronavirus has been recorded. The Royal Berkshire NHS Trust says an elderly patient with an underlying health condition has died.
The first death occurred in the UK.
Michael, we've reached a point where we had known that this virus had been raging for 65 days. And yet for many of us in Europe, the story of coronavirus seemed to be just beginning. But from what you've told me, it was already becoming clear that it was the much earlier decisions that mattered the most. Those decisions taken in the very first few days of the outbreak to get ready for what might happen.
One thing that is very, very clear here is that time is of the essence. I mean, hours matter, days matter. There was a study that came out in March that looked at the responses in China, and it found that if China had done what it did, if it had imposed the quarantines and lockdowns and the rest of it, a week earlier than it did, it would have reduced its caseload by 66%. If it had introduced those measures 3 weeks earlier, it would have reduced the coronavirus caseload by 95%. Equally, if they had waited 3 more weeks, we'd be facing 18 times the cases across China that we eventually did. So time matters.
That was Michael Safi, Patrick Winter and Lily Kuo. Join us tomorrow for part two as coronavirus starts to take hold in Europe. The Guardian is running extensive coverage to mark 100 days of this virus across the website. Do go to theguardian.com to have a read. This episode was produced by Josh Kelly with additional research by Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Nicholas Cox. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.